We're now ready to proceed to the fourth matter on our oral argument calendar today. And that's our last oral matter, and then we will be recessing for non-oral conference of counsel. Our president of the courtroom, you can please go ahead and settle yourselves at the table. And while you're doing that, I'll ask the marshal to call the fourth case so that our audio record is clear. And thank you, counsel, for appellant, for going up there and getting yourselves ready. I just will make a couple of quick remarks. You probably know them anyway, but just to make sure. Please be sure to start your remarks by identifying yourself as well as the client you represent. And keep an eye on the clock. It tends to go quickly, but we do look forward to our conversation with you. So with that, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Charlotte Culbertson, and I represent the appellant respondent, Sean Kerwin, the husband, in the trial court below. We're here today, Your Honors, to bring to you two issues that were of contention in the lower court where we believe that the trial judge abused his discretion, and that is regarding spousal maintenance and the division of the marital estate and the trial court's awarding of an equalizer payment. So a brief factual issues I'd like to remind the court, or I'm sure you read it in the briefs. This was a marriage that started in 2001, and they separated in 2015. There are three minor children. The parties did stipulate to quite a bit prior to the actual trial going to the trial judge. There's substantial issues that the trial judge had to actually decide were a few pieces of property that we are not bringing to the court. We're not going to be disputing the who got the dock and who got the boat lift. It really does come down to the spousal maintenance and the issue of this equalizer payment.
But in both of those areas, aren't you kind of battling uphill against our deference to the broad discretion of the trial court in these areas?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear the beginning of your question.
As to these two areas, aren't you really paddling uphill given our, our broad view of the importance of the trial court having discretion in these areas?
A bit, yes, Your Honor. The trial judge does have broad discretion in both of those areas. However, the statute's very clear that there are threshold limits in which the trial judge has to make a finding first, and I believe that the trial judge failed to meet that threshold finding. And I think when I explain especially with the spousal maintenance, it's very clear.
You seem to be focusing on what her reasonable expenses are, but don't we also look at the standard of living? And here they had a real high standard of living.
I believe the trial court found it to be a comfortable standard of living, but without any actual findings. So I think...
But the court refers to the fact that, they had all these things they could do with boats and recreational vehicles and homes on the lake and all other things that certainly wouldn't be a simple, comfortable living.
That's true, Your Honor. I would not describe it as a simple, comfortable living myself, but that's how the trial court did find it to be, as a comfortable living. But either way, the statute does require that the trial judge find a need for spousal maintenance before he can actually go through the factors and award spousal maintenance. And this trial judge did not do that. The need that's actually described is one that is required, sorry, I'm going blind, not only under the statute but under the case law. And he failed to do that. When you review the record, you'll find that there is no need for this particular plaintiff to have, or this petitioner to have, spousal maintenance. She has sufficient income and she has sufficient investments, and therefore there is no need. She can provide for her expenses, even in a comfortable lifestyle, on a monthly basis with her income and her investments without spousal maintenance.
And how does she do that when he finds that there's a deficiency in what she has coming in and what she needs to cover her reasonable expenses?
I believe that the budget that she presented was exaggerated. I believe that...
They always are. I mean, from an argument standpoint, but the judge seems to have found that she has this amount of resources to handle this amount of need, and the need is greater than the resources she has.
I believe it's up to the trial judge, Your Honor, to scrutinize that. And in this particular case, he not only did he not scrutinize it, he did not put anything in his findings of fact to show how it actually balanced out. He took her word for it verbatim, not even making a credibility determination in his findings, and just flat out said, I'm giving her everything she asks for. That is an abuse of discretion. He at least, in the very least, has to give us some kind of findings of fact as to what he is basing it on and come to a conclusion that her need, that there is a need for spousal maintenance, and then go through the factors of what that actually is. He failed to do that. So his findings are inadequate. It
seems to me that neither party gave the judge all the information that maybe would have been helpful in drafting a perfect set of findings. But it seems like both parties were deficient in that regard. I mean, I don't see a lot of information from him on really what this debt issue is all about. You know, he makes wild claims that he no longer can sell Bobcats to one of his prime customers, but he doesn't back that up with any, you know, records that demonstrate that that's in fact the case.
That's true.
It seems like the record wasn't built very well at the trial court by either side.
I would agree. I would agree, Your Honor, but the trial judge did find in his findings that the my client, Mr. Kerwin, could use a line of credit in which to pay his expenses in the future. And that in itself goes against the definition of what spousal maintenance should be. Spousal maintenance, by definition in the statute, should be based on the income of the paying spouse going into the future to provide for the receiving spouse in the future. And this trial judge felt that it would be fine for my client to continue to go into debt moving into the future.
But he was looking at a past where your client generally earned about $9,000 a month and she earned about $4,000 a month in that ballpark where they were at.
And when they were together, that didn't matter. My client paid all of the expenses. And so that's what he was looking at based when they were together. So he was basing it on that. And then when they separated, my client paid for her house in full. He paid for the lake cabin in full and gave that to her as property, and he paid for a rental investment property for her in full so that she received, as part of the distribution, close to $1 million in investments full with no encumbrances.
But he received the value of the businesses and other things that presumably have more ability to generate income.
Presumably, but he also received the debts on those.
Well, that would make sense if he's going to get the assets.
And they did that by stipulation, Your Honor.
That's right.
Right. And so even though it was a weak trial record, and I would agree with that it wasn't completely developed, the statutory threshold for spousal maintenance is still need. And this record is weak, as is the judge's order. And he did not come to the actual conclusion that she did not need, that she actually needed spousal maintenance. He didn't get there. She does have full-time employment. He found that between her 30-hour-a-week job at the U. He made no decision as to why she's not working 40 hours a week. She has three children who are in school full-time, no special needs. She makes $20 an hour. And then she sells some kind of essential oil business on the side. He did calculate that to be a conclusive full-time employment equivalent. And so she has a decent income. But her expenses, based on the budget that you, Your Honor, actually admits could be inflated, there's receiving the properties that she did and the investment she did, the expenses she would have would be those of an ordinary individual. Your utilities, your phone, your food, and she only has the children 2 weeks out of the month. And husband is paying the private school tuition, husband is providing for their needs, and there are children's expenses also on that budget. So I don't believe that there was good scrutiny on the part of the budget. I think it could either go back for an evidentiary hearing specific to the spousal maintenance issue itself, or this court can reverse just on the fact that there was no need threshold made, in conjunction with the fact that there was this equalizer payment made. This equalizer payment was $300,000 in cash up front. And the court determined, again, that Mr. Kerwin had the access to lines of credit on his business, so therefore he could come up with this equalizer payment. As this court has often decided, marital assets don't need to be equal. They just need to be equitable and fair. But this, even though the parties stipulated to what they felt was a fair and equitable distribution of the assets and the debts, this trial court determined, after seeing the stipulation and agreeing to it, that he was going to come down to something to make it a dollar-for-dollar split and give the wife additional cash to make it a dollar-for-dollar determination, and he awarded her an additional $300,000.
That was later reduced.
Well, it was 308 at first and then reduced to 293. So I was rounding right in the middle to 300. But it was right around 300 in three installments, and by now it has, I believe it's been paid in full. But when you take that $300,000 right up front, Mrs. Kerwin has now received over $1 million, not only in the $900,000 in property at the distribution, but the $300,000 in cash up front, with virtually no debt. $17,000 in debt is what she walked away with. And that debt was on her car that she could turn in at any time and buy a less expensive car if she chose. And so her expenses on a monthly basis are her car and her living expenses. That's it. Mr. Kerwin, on the other hand, yes, he did receive businesses that he's had for many years, 15, 20 years. Yes, Mrs. Kerwin did attribute to those businesses and the success of them. No one is discounting that. But I think there is an inequity when you talk about a cash payment and then ongoing spousal maintenance for 8 years on a monthly basis. It should be one or the other. It doesn't necessarily need to be both. And especially when we're talking about the fair and equitable distribution. She received all of these assets debt-free, the ability to continue to make income from a rental property that was rented out prior to the trial at $900 a month. The testimony came in that it was rented out at $900 a month. And Judge Glassford decided that he didn't think that that was a reasonable amount, and contrary to all of the evidence at trial, discounted that to $500 a month with no evidence to that whatsoever. So he attributed the income to Mrs. Kerwin to $500 a month on the rental property because he felt that that was reasonable, where the only testimony and the party stipulation was that it was rented previously for $900 a month. They explained during testimony that they had not been renting it during the trial, uncertain as to whether they'd be putting it up for sale or renting it out or who would be getting it. So at the time, it was vacant. But the prior renter was $900 a month. So they had no reason to believe it wouldn't rent out again at that same price. But Judge Glassford felt, no, he was going to just discount that to $500. And that was all he was going to attribute to Mrs. Kerwin in the future for that income.
Well, usually don't put in the gross rent as the income. I mean, there's always expenses.
And with this particular property, again, there's no encumbrance on it whatsoever, and there's a minimal amount of tax, which I believe was in the record. I believe it was under $200 a year, and it had been recently maintained. So even a nominal amount of maintenance, I think, could get it to $700, I think, was what the record reflected when asked. But he discounted it to $5, which is almost in half. So I believe the inequities are there to justify that with the equalizer payment, there should be no spousal maintenance. There was no need met for the threshold on the statutory requirement for the spousal maintenance, and there was no necessary equalizer because the parties had already stipulated to a fair and equitable distribution of the marital assets, with Mr. Kerwin being responsible for the lion's share of the debt, having taken almost $2 million in debt, and then having to be saddled with even additional debt, as Judge Glassford felt it was appropriate for him to pull on lines of credit to pay off the additional cash payment to Mrs. Kerwin. Thank you.
And counsel, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. I believe it's still morning. My name is Catherine Graves. I am the attorney for the respondent on this appeal, Heidi Karn. Your Honor, I just wanted to point out before I get into my argument specifically with reference to the last comment that counsel made, the parties did stipulate as to the majority of the values of the assets, and they did stipulate as to how those assets would be divided. We did not stipulate as to whether or not Mr. Kerwin was going to have to pay my client an equalizer. That's why we went to trial. And so to indicate that that was something that maybe the trial judge just came up with is not accurate. As you pointed out, Judge Kirk, the appellant does have is paddling uphill. He has to prove that the trial judge in this case abused his discretion when he granted my client temporary spousal maintenance of $800 a month for approximately 8 years and gave her what amounted to an equal division of the marital assets. In order to prove that, he would have to show that there was not facts in the record to support the judge's decision or that there were errors of law. No argument has been made that Judge Glassford made any errors of law. So then this court is left to say, were there facts in the record that would support the court's decision? And obviously, as we've argued in our brief, we believe that there was. The court did make findings of fact about my client's income at findings of fact 22 and 23. In fact, he overstated what my client's income was by about $300. He made a math error. And without child support or spousal maintenance, she had a total income of $3,433, and that includes $3,933, which includes her regular income, some income from a part-time job, and then the $500 a month of rental income that the court decided she could earn. And as you pointed out, the one thing that did come out on cross-examination of Mr. Kerwin was that the property that was awarded my client had never cash flowed. Now, he agreed as a part of the settlement that he was going to pay off the mortgage, but still, so the judge's decision that he would attribute $500 a month for rental income is reasonable and is supported by the facts in the record. The court also made findings of fact about my client's budget. That's in, I believe it's finding of fact 25. In findings of fact 26, he made findings concerning Mr. Kerwin's budget. And he made, in the conclusions of law, he made a conclusion that my client did not have sufficient income to meet her reasonable budget, given the standard of living that the parties had enjoyed during the marriage. And there's abundance of facts in the record to support that. Two of the arguments that Mr. Kerwin is making on appeal were not issues that were ever raised or any evidence was ever provided to the trial court. So this court doesn't have any ability to rule on that and should not. One is whether or not the court should have attributed income on my client's cash property settlement. There's no evidence in the record as to what the interest rate might be on that. Mr. Kerwin had an opportunity when he filed a motion for amended findings to ask the court to include that because he knew at that point that it was possible that he was going to have to pay my client, a large amount of money, but he didn't do that. He also did not make any argument about what the amount of rental income would be if my client were to sell their lake property, which was an argument that he did make in court. I don't know how serious of an issue it is or not, but in their brief, they raised the issue of whether or not my client was working, wasn't full-time income attributed to my client. Again, that issue was simply never raised. We presented evidence in our case as to what my client's income was from the different sources. We had income tax returns. There had also been a temporary hearing, and that's because Mr. Kerwin didn't present any evidence about his income at the trial. When I prepared my proposed findings, that's what I used because that information was in the court record. And that included, it was based on the party's tax returns. There was absolutely no evidence about his income in 2017 or 2018. As far as the other big issue, which is raised in their brief, which is that it was an abuse of discretion for the court to A, order their client to pay spousal maintenance while also ordering a large property settlement, and B, that you know the court should have taken into consideration the fact that he was assuming a large amount of debt. The trial court made several findings concerning that, which support his decision to award the parties an equal division of marital assets. One, and I do recall that Mr. Kerwin was questioned on cross-examination about this, that they had always, he's a farmer. That's what farmers do. They carry large loads of debt in order to keep their business going. And then they pay it off when they sell their crop, or in this case, he sells his calves in the fall. He had a bobcat business. He sold implements. Again, he's always going to be carrying some type of line of credit from his, and clearly, you know, he admitted that. The judge made findings about that when finding that that Mr. Kerwin had the ability to pay what was owed my client. I don't really have much to add, Your Honor. This is really just a case where, you know, you're asked to decide whether there's sufficient facts in the record to support what the trial court did. Obviously, we believe that there was, and I think that's thoroughly briefed. So unless the court has any questions, I really don't have anything to add. I would just ask that the court deny the appeal and affirm the trial court in all respects.
You know, on her employment, was there any evidence at all that she could have worked more than 30 hours at the U?
I don't recall if I asked her on direct examination, Your Honor, so I don't want to guess. It is my recollection that she worked the hours that were available to her. She worked for the University of Minnesota Morris. And she did have another part-time income, which, or, you know, from selling some kind of beauty products or something like that, really equaled what would be full-time income.
Thank you, counsel.
Questions?
I don't think so.
Okay. No, thank you. Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel. The matter was well briefed and well argued. It is now submitted to this court for a decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. So with that, this court will be in recess for its non-oral calendar.